In the KSRO kitchen, I'm Steve Garner, along with Chef John Ash. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Still a little jet lagged, to
tell
you the
truth. Where
have
you been?
I went to the African continent and the country of Morocco for a couple of weeks. This is on my bucket list.
You're going to talk about it today.
A little bit today. Okay. Probably more next week as my faculties get improved. But it was both of Mrs. Garner and I's on our bucket list. We wanted to visit the continent of Africa.
Had you been there before?
I had not. Neither of us had been there. Many people we know have been to South Africa.
Uh-huh.
A lot of people, very popular safari destination and all that. But we wanted to see a different part of Africa, and we wanted to experience some Arabic country and Muslim country.
So maybe I'm going to ask you now. Did you feel threatened?
Not a bit. Not once.
Okay.
I feel more threatened, I have to tell you, sometimes walking in cities in the United States than I ever did in all the cities that we visited during a couple of weeks in Morocco. Not once. Obviously, you have to be prudent wherever you are in large cities. You don't walk around at 3 a.m. and you don't walk around with your cell phone out. And theft can happen anywhere. But we found the Moroccan people to be helpful, courteous, very well educated, articulate. The scenery, of course, was very different than anything I'd been. Now, I'd been down to Death Valley and places like that.
But
in the cities, you don't get the sense that you're in a desert country at all. The cities are very modern. They function very, very well. Every amenity you would expect in larger American cities.
Did you have great food?
We had great food. Yeah. And, of course, a lot of couscous and a lot of Mediterranean salads and grilled chicken and grilled lamb. Mint tea several times a day, which I really have an affinity. Actually, I'm drinking mint tea this morning.
That's great.
And we had a great time. Overall, I would love to go back. Have you visited that part of the world?
Long, long time ago. I mean, I was thinking when I knew you were going, I tried to call it up in my memory banks, and I couldn't remember it. Other than it was exotic.
Exotic. Had you been to Turkey before?
Yeah, I've been to Turkey.
Oh, you have.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that was our first introduction several years ago to an exotic Muslims country where the call to prayer happens 5, 6, 7 hour times a day, starting at 5:30 in the morning. And we rapidly got used to that. It wasn't intrusive at all. Life continues and functions. You know, not everything comes to a standstill. What were the high points? I think, like everything, the people.
I
find that the most memorable parts of my travels have been a connection with people.
Well, you were lucky, and you're going to tell us about that, that you had a great guide.
We had a very special connection. About 22 years ago, John and I interviewed Kitty Morris. She's a great author, a great cook, and we've had her on a number of times. But this was a special book called Sephardic Cuisine from Morocco, The Scent of Orange Blossoms. Mm-hmm. She wrote that cookbook with Danielle Maman, who is also from Fez, born and raised French Arabic. But of course, we couldn't have her on the show. We couldn't call Morocco during that. But I arranged, through Kitty's help, to meet with Danielle, which was wonderful. We spent a day with Danielle going around Fez, visiting different markets. She took us into her home where she made us a beautiful afternoon dessert and tea. And she gave us her impressions of Fez and Morocco. And even though we were on a very good tour, that day spent with her was the highlight of the tour. Anytime you can connect with someone who's born and raised in the country, you get a completely different idea and viewpoint about the country versus a tour, which does a great job.
Yeah.
But there's not that personal connection that we felt.
Yeah.
And we will never forget our day with Danielle.
So what was the most memorable food you had, since this is a food show?
I would say a number of the tagines that we had. They were very exotic.
And what is a tagine?
You know very well. They worship semolina. It is couscous.
Yeah.
It's made in this beautiful earthenware pot with water and chicken and or lamb or vegetarian. And it's cooked low and slow. And then they take the top off this tagine, and the aroma, the steam comes out. And it just so memorable, and there's so many riffs on it, of course.
There's
some add almonds, different kinds of nuts. I even had one with sardines, which was very unusual. But the traditional ones have different fruits and vegetables. There's sweet and sour components of the tagine, and everything, of course, you're judged by the quality of your couscous. Some were good, others were ethereal, fluffy, light, fragrant, the scent of saffron, and some had orange in them, the scent of bitter oranges, which was wonderful too. The ones that had bitter orange gave another dimension, dried fruit, of course, in there too. So we had tagine probably at least 5 or 6 times out of the 10, 11 days.
So I'll tell you, I made couscous myself a couple of times. It's pasta. It's just pasta. It's semolina flour, and it's moistened, and then put through a kind of screen and rubbed around until you get little, I don't know what you call them, little...
Granules?
Yeah, that's what it is. That's what comes out the other end, and then those are dried, and then it's cooked, and it takes no time at all.
Minutes.
Yeah.
It's minutes, and it absorbs all the flavor, of course, of the juices of whatever meat your poultry you're using, and the vegetables, and... It's such a nourishing dish that we never got tired of it, because the riffs, every cook has their own special approach and their own seasoning. The complexity of the seasoning is very memorable, too, in Morocco, which we loved, and especially that hint of saffron, which you pick up in a lot of the dishes. We made a pact with ourselves, my wife and I, to eat as much Bastilla as possible. Bastilla uses a flaky pastry that encases either chicken or, in this case, the dark meat, which is pigeon, which was the real authentic one, and almonds, and it is a baked dish and usually some powdered sugar on top. And there are infinite riffs about this dish also. So any restaurant that featured it, we ordered. So we probably had Bastilla 6 or 8 times. Never got tired of it. Anything flaky, pastry encased, I'm down with that. So that was wonderful. And of course, Morocco is a cookie culture. They love their cookies. Well, a country that consumes mint tea 6 or 8 times a day,
Of course.
What goes perfectly?
Yeah.
So there are an infinite variety, especially in the markets. There's family cookie companies that have been going since 1928.
Wow.
1928, they have it proudly displayed over their booth. 5 generations of cookie makers. So it's quite a entrenched historical part of the Medina to find these cookie booths.
So you brought me back a box, right?
Didn't make it back.
Yeah.
I mean, I had the earmark for you, but somehow on the plane I got really hungry.
Yeah.
So I'm sorry about that. Well, and we hope to have Kitty back again soon to talk a little bit more in depth about Moroccan cuisine, the Sephardic influence, the Berber influence, actually how evolved Moroccans are as far as promoting women into high positions, a woman president, they've been way ahead of the rest of the world as far as women's rights, way ahead of us, even here in the States, and we think we're so involved in the West. Also, democracy, they're probably the most democratic of any of the Arabic states. Morocco has moved very slow because they did it slowly. You can't come in and impose democracy on a civilization that's hundreds of years old and expect good results. Look at Tunisia and other places where that backfired. But the Moroccans were smart. They instituted democratic principles slowly over the years, and thus they've been very successful in their government. Anyway.
So what's the landscape like? How would you describe it? I mean, I guess it's desert. Huh?
Well, it is desert, but there's a lot of greenery. Olives. Lots of olives. Yeah. And a thriving wine business, too. Back after this.
Did you know that KSRO is more committed than ever to updated local news? 4 updates an hour mornings. Updated local news at noon. 2 updates an hour afternoons. All day coverage of local news on KSRO.
Chernoff Cosmetic Surgery in Santa Rosa has been taking excellent care of patients for over 30 years.
There's such a difference between doing things to people and taking good care of patients. And I've been blessed in my practice to be surrounded by people who know the difference.
Dr. Chernoff likes to use the term your natural best when advising patients on what procedures to have.
Our nicest compliment is always to create their aesthetic improvement such that no one ever knows that they've had it done. And that means creating a natural appearance, never a done appearance, never a pulled appearance.
He not only trains doctors and nurses nationwide, but also ensures his staff receives training to the same high standards.
I am proud to be referred to as a pioneer in the field of aesthetics because we have been deeply involved in the research and development of many techniques, both non-surgical and surgical.
Check the specials and services at ChernoffCosmeticSurgery.com.
Honey, we need to make reservations for Buckley for our vacation. He loves going to daycare at Paradise Pet Resorts. Let's see if they have room for boarding.
That's a great idea.
Yeah, it makes it so much easier to leave him, knowing they'll take care of him like he's their own.
Paradise Pet Resorts will take great care of your furry family member. You get to go away, and your pet gets a vacation. See for yourself on the webcams. Just download the app and look at all those wagging tails.
Dogs are pack animals who don't do well left alone all day. They need plenty of mental and physical exercise, as well as lots of opportunities to play, sniff, explore, and socialize. Doggy daycare is a practical solution for keeping your dog stimulated, as opposed to chewing, digging, and barking when you're not home.
Pets prefer Paradise. Pet tested, pet approved. Book now for boarding and daycare. Paradise Pet Resorts in Rohnert Park in Santa Rosa. ParadisePetResorts.com.
Beware the buzz. Mosquitoes aren't just annoying, they can transmit diseases like West Nile virus. But fear not. The key to staying safe is simple. Prevent those mosquito bites.
EPA registered insect repellents are your best defense. Safe for everyone, including pregnant women and kids. When selecting repellents, check for EPA registered active ingredients like DEET, picaridin, or oil of lemon eucalyptus.
Don't let mosquitoes ruin your day. Protect yourself and your loved ones. Learn more at msmosquito.org.
Oh no, stomach issues again?
Stomach issues?
Who are you?
Your pancreas. I could be the real reason for your diarrhea, gas, bloating, stomach pain, or loose oily stools.
I thought it was my stomach.
People often do, but any of these symptoms could mean having a condition called exocrine pancreatic insufficiency, or EPI. With EPI, the pancreas doesn't release enough enzymes to break down food, but EPI is manageable. Use the symptom checker on identifyepi.com and speak with your doctor. That's identifyepi.com. Sponsored by AbbVie.
KSRO, AM, FM, and online. Depend on it.
John asked me off the air about the tour company that put together a lot of our tour, and it was Gate One, G-A-T-E One. They do a lot of tours around the world, but they're very well known for their tours to Morocco. Our guide was superb. Born in Germany, mother German, father Arabic, so he spoke fluent German, fluent Arabic. Also, of course, fluent French, because you do take French in Moroccan schools. Yeah. And then he spent a couple years here in the States in the late 70s. He said, I was a hippie when the United States. So he spoke fluent English also. And that's the type of tour guide you get on. I think most of the companies are able to enlist and find people that are really passionate. Yeah. Yeah. He knew the history. He knew the cultural mores. He had a great sense of humor. Any issues that came up during the tour, he was able to effortlessly and with great humor solve any issues that came up. So I'd have to give a plug out to Gate One. I'd never done a tour before. It's always been independent travel for me. But I felt this time going to Morocco,
but that's a
good
different
idea.
Part of the world.
Different part of the world. It was. Well, it gives me great pleasure at this time to introduce Michelle Rosemary Jordan to our listeners. Michelle Anna Jordan is a wonderful guest of ours that we had on a while back to talk about one of the great ideas, I think, in Western culture, and that is to pair a dinner with a really wild movie. Michelle, tell us about this.
Well, this is the culmination of our 24th season. It's a project between me and the Rialto Cinemas. They're wonderful people to work with. And tonight's dinner is Rosemary's Baby, which is a culmination of so many things for me because, honestly, it's my favorite movie. And we are going to have a lot of fun. It's a five-course menu this time. The menus in the past have been either 3 to 4 courses, but I'm adding an extra one because to celebrate the conclusion of a successful year. You can read about this, especially about the movie. The movie is much more wide, held in really great regard, more than I had realized. And in the 50th anniversary in 2018, a book was published about behind the scenes, the filming of the movie. And I checked to see if I could find a copy, and it's available for $1,400. But there were some very interesting articles written about the time. One of them is about viewing Rosemary's Baby in the era of Me Too. And it talks about how it shouldn't be categorized as a horror flick. It's not a horror flick unless you want to call it feminist horror. It's very much a feminine movie. It's told from the point of view of Rosemary Woodhouse, played by, of course, Mia Farrow, who has called it the one great movie she was ever in. She said no other movie had ever asked as much of her as that movie did. So I was happy to see that, you know, my choice of best movie isn't really as silly as I sometimes thought it was. So a lot of the food, or all of the food, is in some way inspired by the movie.
So you have to share with us. It's like I was saying to Steve before you came on, what food do you think of when you think of Rosemary's Baby?
Well, it was actually really easy for me. First of all, early in the movie, her husband, Guy, and Rosemary go to Rosemary's friend Hutch's house for dinner, and he has leg of lamb on the table, and they comment on how delicious the leg of lamb is. So that's one of the courses. But we start out, I think everybody remembers the scene when Rosemary sees herself in the toaster as she's chewing on raw beef liver. That was a pretty tough moment in the film. So I have made, not raw, but I've made a really delicious chicken liver mousse. In England, it would be called potted meat. And it's really just chicken livers, butter, some cognac, some nutmeg, and salt and pepper. And that will be served with pomegranate jam and crackers.
Lovely.
So that's the first course, and I've sampled it. It is, the pairing is delicious. Next, I'm doing chilled late season tomato sauce with dead ripe tomatoes and some avocado cream swirled on top. And then we get to the main course. And there's a slice of leg of lamb, But then paired with the leg of lamb is a Tunisian rice and lamb pilaf that is one of the best things I've ever eaten. I saw it in a restaurant in uptown New York many years ago, a little tiny place called A Piece, and it was so delicious. I went back the next night and had the exact same thing and figured out how to make it. So we have this the rice pilaf, and it includes chickpeas, cilantro, parsley, and rosemary. And then alongside are some julienned sweet peppers to add an acidic contrast. Next comes a cheese course with just a little wedge of brie, some microgreens from Earthworker Farms, and pomegranate scattered over the top. And we can figure, you know, you can figure out the relationship between pomegranates and the devil. That's pretty easy to do. And then if you remember the movie, you know what dessert is. It is chocolate mousse.
Oh, yes.
Of course.
Give us the particulars, Michelle, on how do we get the few remaining tickets.
Okay. You go to rialtocinemas.com. You click, and the window pops up, the page pops up, and on the left, you'll see Sonoma County. Click on that. It will pop up with an image of the movie and then a link to take you there, and you can sign up right away. You can go to just the dinner, you can go to just the movie, or you can go to both. And the prices and how to do it is there. All, you know, it's all there on the website.
And
there are two additional things. There is an optional costume contest, and the details are on the website. And, I mean, all you have to do is get a lampshade, tack some paper flowers on it, throw a feather boa around your neck, and you're mini Castevet. You know, you can like tie a pillow around your midsection, put on a baby blue nightgown or bathrobe, and you're Mia.
It's Michelle Anna Jordan. It's the next dinner. It's tomorrow, October 13th at the Rialto in Sebastopol. Rosemary's Baby with all the trimmings. Thank you, Michelle.
Yeah, it starts at 5:30, so 5:30. Get there a little bit early.
Great.
Thank you so much for giving me this time. I really appreciate it.
You bet. Well, we want to make sure it's a sellout. Back after this with a great new cookbook.
Sonoma County's News Talk, KSRO, on FM at 103.5 in Santa Rosa and Windsor, and now at 96.9 in Petaluma.
What is one of Dr. Tom's favorite procedures?
The waist area is one of my favorite areas to perform smart lipo laser liposuction for both women and men. When our patients regain their waistline, they have renewed self-confidence. They love the way they fit in their clothes and how they look in the mirror. Even a small reduction in waist size can take years off your silhouette.
Dr. Tom introduced Smart Lipo to the North Bay in 2007. He has performed hundreds of these procedures under local anesthesia.
Local anesthesia is safe and well tolerated by our patients. You can actually have breakfast on the day of your surgery, and you'll appreciate quicker recovery with less discomfort.
There's a reason he's been voted the Press Democrat's best cosmetic surgeon of Sonoma County 8 years in a row. Reclaim your waist and proudly put your hands on your hips.
Let's stay young together.
Contact Dr. Tom for a complimentary consultation. More info at drtomcosmetic.com. drtomcosmetic.com.
Join Chef John Ash, the two-time James Beard Award-winning cookbook author, teacher, and host of the Good Food Hour for an exclusive 2025 culinary cruise.
Set sail from Seattle and journey through breathtaking Alaskan scenery while learning new cooking techniques from Chef Ash.
This exclusive cruise includes an intimate cooking class with Chef Ash, a welcome cocktail reception, and other opportunities just for our group.
Enjoy cruising on the ultra-premium cruise line Oceana aboard Oceana's Riviera. With just a 1,250 guest capacity, discover what small ship luxury truly means.
Join Chef Ash at our next cruise mixer Wednesday, October 16th from 6 to 7:30 at Ketchum Estate Winery in Healdsburg, the official winery of the 2025 Culinary Cruise. Each cabin will also enjoy a welcome bottle of wine. RSVP to secure your spot. Email Elise Corey of TravelWise at cruise@travelwise.net or call 707-935-WIZE.
Go to this station's website and click on the 2025 Cruise for more info.
When you flip a switch, the lights always come on. And when you turn the faucet, beautiful clean water. When it's hot outside, coming inside to a cool home is wonderful. When it's cold outside, having a cozy house is so comforting. It's easy to take our modern comforts for granted until something breaks or wears out. Ongaro & Sons knows things rarely go wrong, but when they do, you need help right away. An affordable option is Ongaro & Sons with 0% interest financing up to 72 months on HVAC, electrical, and plumbing repair or replacement. You can schedule an appointment right now at OngaroAndSons.com. OngaroAndSons.com. Ongaro & Sons has proudly served the North Bay for over 90 years, specializing in best-in-class solutions. Call Ongaro & Sons, your trusted home systems partner, now with 72-month 0% financing on HVAC, electrical, and plumbing. Limitations and restrictions apply. Minimum purchase required. Ongaro & Sons.
License number 254603.
Aunt Laura? Holy, we're here 1 minute, gone the next. Aunt Laura!
What's up, Danny?
Oh, geez. I was just... Wait, where did you come from?
My office. What's up?
Oh, well, I was thinking about Gatelli Gold.
The Comfort Club loyalty credits?
Yes, and that Gatelli Gold is also the standard that Grandpa Gatelli has passed down to us.
Dad always did want us to do a better job than anyone else.
He told me once that if you are not happy with any part of the service, that we should always make it right.
It's settled then.
Aunt Laura?
Gold standard service. If you're not happy, we'll make it perfect.
Always?
Always.
G-O-T-E-L-L-I. Go tell me.
Okay, make it so, Danny.
Okay, Aunt Laura, I will.
Gotta go.
And gone again.
For Gatelli's guaranteed gold standard service, visit us online at GatelliPlumbing.com.
As the leaves turn and the air cools, the real estate market is experiencing its own season of change, offering unique advantages and unique challenges.
Hi, I'm Allison Norman.
And I'm Stephanie Norman.
We're the Norman Home Team.
This fall, we're celebrating the much-needed rate reductions, bringing more buyers to the market and more sellers deciding the time is right to make a move.
We're also adjusting to some big changes affecting most residential real estate transactions, both buyers and sellers.
When you're ready, we're here to guide you through the evolving landscape with personalized service and up-to-date insights.
We know the market, and we're ready to help you navigate the changes for a smooth transaction.
Now more than ever, who you work with matters. Contact the Norman Home Team, the North Bay's newest mother-daughter real estate team. For questions or to make a no-obligation appointment, go to AllisonNorman.com, the Norman Home Team at Keller Williams Realty. Because two heads are better than one.
DRE license number 01720334 and 02209237.
Imagine a place where tradition meets innovation, a place where every baker from beginner to pro is part of a thriving community. Welcome to Central Milling's Artisan Baking Center in Petaluma, where this beautiful facility is more than just a state-of-the-art baking facility. It's a hub for lifelong learning and skill mastery.
With world-class instructors in a variety of classes tailored to all skill levels, you'll find the perfect fit, whether you're just starting out or refining your craft. And right now, use the coupon code BAKE15 to get 15% off any in-person class.
Artisan Baking Center is not just a baking facility. It's the farmer, the miller, and the baker all working together to preserve American farmland for tomorrow. Employee owned and operated, their team is personally invested in the quality of their products.
Go online to see all the classes available, from pizza to desserts, baguettes to pastas. You're going to find a class just right for you. Use code BAKE15 to get 15% off any in-person class. Go to centralmilling.com and click on Bake.
In the KSRO kitchen, I'm Steve Garner, along with Chef John Ash. And we're happy to welcome our guest this morning, and that's Chef 2, Chef Chef to David Phu. His new book is Vietnamese American Recipes from Phu Quoc, Oakland, and the Spaces Between. The book is entitled The Memory of Taste. Good morning, David, and thanks for joining John and me this morning.
Good morning, John. Good morning, Steve. Such an honor.
Nice to have you on the show. Memory of taste, would you tell us what that means in your life?
I think the memory of taste is a universal aspect of how people relate to food, specifically our mothers. When our mothers are cooking in the kitchen, they're usually thinking of a pastime previously that they experienced, and they're trying to replicate that in the kitchen. And for me, this book is dedicated to that, but in my own memory and my mother's memory of what we experienced in the kitchen cooking together.
So I it was interesting that you talk about in the beginning of the book that you were somebody trained deeply in Western cooking, not in Vietnamese cooking. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yes, I was, to reference, I am a first generation Vietnamese American from Oakland. My parents are refugees, and our food experience are of diaspora, specifically to the Americas, so very American. And being in America, those were the types of foods that I saw a lot of. Those were the restaurants that we ate in when there was opportunity to do so. And then, of course, being a professional, that's the places where I cooked and trained. And it was just... there are absolutely cultural bridges, but for the most part, it was completely different from how my mom and dad cooked at home.
So was there a breaking point? Was there a moment in your career, because you spent a lot of times in fine dining at very high-end restaurants, where you said, this is not who I am, this is not where I want to spend the rest of my life cooking this type of food? Was there a breaking point? Was there a specific incident, or was this a slow build?
I think it was, I came out right out of high school, went to culinary school in my, about 18, 19 years old, and about 10 years in working professional establishments. And once again, not just fine dining, I've done the low end, not the low end, but I've done the fast casual. I used to work in a deli all the way up to like a fine dining restaurant, everything in between. I've done pizza shops as well too. I mean, every job that you do as a young person, especially in the food industry, but yeah, I think it came to a point where as I started to climb the sort of the hierarchy of kitchens and I started to be able to contribute my own menu ideas and dishes, I think about that time around 2014, I wanted to cook my mother's food because that was the trendy thing for chefs. Everything from the Jacques Pepins and the Thomas Cullors and even the Alice Waters, right? People were paying homage to their cultural backgrounds, if not their own families, and I wanted to do the same. However, at the establishment that I was at, which I will politely not name or keep unnamed, it wasn't well received. And I think the energy and charge that I had at the time, I think it fueled a fire in me to kind of cook my mother's food. Thus having me break away from the professional establishments and throw these informal cooking dinners that were called, and still do to this day, they're called pop-ups. So, and that started my journey.
And where are you currently working?
I have a multitude of different projects that I'm working in. I just finished a book. So I'm an author. The cookbook is appropriately titled In the Memory Taste, which we're talking about. But I'm opening a restaurant wine bar in San Francisco called Gigi's, and that's in Divisadero. Oh. That's opening in November. And I have a bunch of projects in the NGO space in regards to seafood and seafood sustainability. And then I have some other projects in retail. That's a whole nother conversation.
Okay.
I could do that on a separate call.
Sure.
But you didn't talk about in this book about sustainability, and we're a little tough on some of those who have taken that sustainability mantle. Talking about 11 Madison Avenue and the Willows Inn and all of that. And your comment was that they're not the real deal.
I think there's oftentimes terms, especially in the Western world, they become inflated and then they become inaccurate the way we use them. Everything from words from authenticity, which we'll probably talk a little bit later. But sustainability is one of those words where it started in the scientific space, in the conservation space, right? Where it was an effort and understanding and trying to get a better pulse on where Mother Nature is or where conservation is in terms of trying to regenerate things, get things back to the way they were in terms of nature standards. But as it started to migrate from not just the conservation space into agricultural space and into restaurants, that term started to evolve and it started to bastardize. People started to bastardize the term, to enterprise the term. So you see things on menus and restaurants where it's like, this is sustainable. I'm like, but do you really know what that means? When I use that term, I do it with, and I'm not the world's best expert, but I did put in the time and the understanding to kind of get in depth what that term means, including the travel. My colleagues on projects that I work on and the people who helped me inform write this book as experts in advertising, they're actually the world's top marine biologists in the seafood space, let alone the ocean space. And people in those same spaces are responsible of how seafood is moved in the ecosystem in terms of in the United States ecosystem, let alone Europe and Asia. So with this sort of definition, I'm going to tell you guys, this is their understanding of it. So it's not me. I'm actually quoting them, is that sustainability, like science, is not the understanding, but the effort. When you talk about sustainability, it's a forever evolving definition. We don't know that farmed salmon is unsustainable or will be always be unsustainable, right? And we need to keep it loose and gray because every new year, the world's changing and then we get new data, right? Another fun fact is like we always demonize wild tuna. The bluefin tuna run in the Pacific is so abundant right now, and all of the marine biologists, I think this report came out of Monterey Bay Aquarium a few weeks ago, they're encouraging everyone to eat Pacific bluefin tuna because they're saying that this run is so massive right now, is actually more sustainable in terms of energy input, carbon, everything in between in terms of measurables and metrics. It's a lot more sustainable than what ocean-pinned farmed fish of the equivalent of tuna, right? So when I, once again, when I may say this term sustainability, right, it is not a definite term. It just represents a space. And what I'm accusing of people who use it in the food industry, in particular restaurants, they are using it to promote themselves of this fixed idea of what sustainability is, what it tastes like, what it looks like, where it should come from. And that's not only that it's unethical, it's inaccurate, but it's prejudice, right?
Yeah.
So
a lot of times when people say sustainability, they're saying buy only from California, don't buy from the other states, buy only from the Gulf of the United States, don't buy from Pacific Northwest. And then these are my friends, once again, are the same people who created the Smart Catch, Monterey Bay Aquarium Seafood Watch program. They learned years later that they're actually, that program, it's evolved since then, but initially it was discriminating people based on their geographic location. They were saying, don't buy from this country or that country, and that's not fair, right? So I think my hope is to spark and ask the right questions, right, and call out what is incorrect so we can have those really hard and difficult conversations.
So one of the things that you mentioned, which touched me, was the idea of if you're going to cook in a sustainable way, or have any sustainable sense about you, it is to pay attention to waste, and that we waste, restaurants especially, waste so much in their desire to get the choice cuts of whatever it is that they're serving, that a lot of stuff gets thrown away that is perfectly usable. And you have some great recipes in the book that talk about that.
Yeah, thank you for that. I work in those establishments where we would throw away three cases of frisée for the perfect frisée.
Yeah.
Right. And then those same chefs, in the ethos of them, you know, cooking their mother's peasant dishes, which usually was either Italian or French, would never let that fly. And they would talk about it. It wasn't their fault in particular, but it's just the way the restaurants were ran and the ecosystem that it existed in is that, you know, you would never throw away that much. And I think the greatest cuisines in the world aren't the ones who have three Michelin stars, but the greatest cuisines in the world are from people in countries where they've starved, right? The French, you know, the French, the Jewish, the Italian, the Black American South. There was a time where chicken wings was only fed to dogs, right? Same thing with ribs. And it's like it's the hottest thing right now. Same thing with oxtail, right? These throwaway ingredients that we make something beautiful and delicious. And I'm hoping, not to make a tongue-in-cheek sort of book or essay or narrative, but like I'm hoping to encourage people in the food industry and beyond to kind of revisit, you know, where great food and sustainable food, where it could come from and what the ethos of it.
That's why we were looking forward to our conversation with you, David, because you're a very deep thinker on a lot of different levels. This is much more than not only is it a very fine cookbook, but you really tackle some issues that are avoided in most cookbooks because they may be slightly off-putting or a little controversial, but I like that you've addressed
them. Or false.
Exactly. Yeah. So thank you for including the chapter on sustainability.
So I have a question about you. You include in the beginning of the book the pantry and talk about all of the interesting ingredients in your world. And you give a shout-out to MSG.
Oh, MSG, yes. I think the thing is that MSG, you know, at the end of the day, if I wanted to make MSG, it's as simple as me going out to the ocean, harvesting seaweed, boiling it in water until it turns into salt and reducing it down. It's basically MSG, right? And there's different forms of MSG. Like, I think Parmesan is probably one of my favorite forms of MSG, right? So, but I want to make things very clear. Like, MSG, to me, we should treat it just like sugar. We should treat it just like salt. We should treat it just like any other ingredient. And we need to eat everything in moderation. Just because I say MSG is okay to use, we shouldn't use it in abundance, just like every other ingredient, right? So I just want to make that clear. And also, I think it's important that my cookbook and the tone of my cookbook is that I wanted to make it accessible. Not that it needs to be layman's, not that it needs to be dumbed down or diluted in any sense, but I think that's – I wanted my book to be relatable. I wanted people who weren't of Vietnamese origins. I wanted people who were across the different economic classes to be able to tune into what I'm talking about, right? Like if I made a recipe that was quote-unquote authentic where you can only get fresh pandan, you know, in California, like – I'm not inviting people to cook, right? So, and that's the other thing too. Like my mother, she faced those same challenges, and I wanted to welcome people to go through this journey on the challenges my mother had, where she had a yearning for a flavor palette, a dish that only existed in Vietnam. She had to find adaptation to make it work here. Like I wanted to celebrate that, and like I don't feel that story's been told because so many of our mothers went through that, no matter what ethnic or cultural background or birthright you have, right? And I think, for me, I think that the biggest joy that I have in my life and my culinary career was that I was able to identify that, regardless of the fact that my mother was a marginalized woman who worked in sweatshops for most of her life and getting paid by the pound for the garments that she sewn, right? Like, and I've learned that especially working with my scientist friends and marine biologists, is that I learned that valuable knowledge, you know, great resources, great thinking, right? Great ideas can come from anywhere, and particularly your mother.
Well, you mentioned that these recipes really are from your mother. I mean, you might have written them and certainly organized them, but they're your mom's cooking at its heart.
Well, you know, even with all of your formal culinary training, you said in the very beginning of the book, you learn most of what you cook, your recipes, came from your parents.
As everyone else is, like I think I come with a different lens perspective. I think we come from a sort of, at least my generation, come from a very sort of narcissistic sort of narrative where they're like, I'm self-made. And that's anything but true. And I want to go back and then have this understanding, revisit the understanding of that. Remember that old saying, it takes a village to raise a child? Mm-hmm. That's where I'm at in my career, where I'm understanding that my mother, everyone in community with me, all my teachers, the nonprofit, you know, the community organization spaces, mentors, you know, my old former bosses that pulled me aside and said I did a good job, where I learned a little bit from, is that this book is not my book. This voice is not my voice. This, you know, it's my responsibility to show and highlight everyone's voices, ideas, that, and effort that was invested into me. That needs to reflect in my voice.
We'll take
and
a quick
break. I see that as a responsibility. Yeah.
Well, let's take a real quick break. Back in about 2 or 3 minutes, David. And we'll get into the book in the time remaining. It's called The Memory of Taste, Vietnamese-American Recipes from Phu Quoc. That was David's parents' village in Vietnam where they grew up, and David's been back to the village. Oakland, where he grew up, and the spaces between. I'm Steve Garner, along with Chef John Ash, in the KSRO kitchen, celebrating our 38th year, America's longest running radio food show.
Agricultural community farmers markets bring you fresh produce, meat, and dairy each week year round.
Petaluma has 2 farmers markets open for the season. The Eastside Market at Lucchese Park Tuesdays from 10 to 1:30 and Walnut Park Saturdays from 2 to 5 p.m. through November 23rd. Chicken, lamb, and beef are available from the local farmers and ranchers, including Betha Springs Ranch in Petaluma. Get Petaluma cheeses from Acadena Cheese. Baked goods from Redbird, Hillsburg Bagel, and Bedstone Bakery. Petaluma's own Strauss Family Creamery with certified organic milk, yogurt, butter, and ice cream. Seasonal vegetables from Sonoma County local Ortiz Family Farm. Anna's Seafood sells fish straight from the docks. Grab restaurant-quality lunch or dinner from Tacos Don Pepe with vegan options. What a Chicken and Belle Fare featuring their award-winning chicken sandwich. You'll also find fresh honey and local artisans and crafters. Order online for curbside shopping service. More info at ilovefarmersmarkets.org.
During Cybersecurity Awareness Month, LifeLock wants to give you helpful tips to protect your identity. Using multi-factor authentication can be a line of defense to help protect your personal information. But LifeLock offers comprehensive protection against identity theft. LifeLock not only alerts you to suspicious uses of your personal information, but also fixes issues that arise, guaranteed or your money back. Protect your identity today with a 30-day free trial at LifeLock.com. Use my name, Clay, as the promo code. Terms apply.
Mountain Mike's, the official pizza of your San Francisco 49ers, is the perfect place to enjoy the games. Happy hour specials Monday through Thursday and all Sunday long. Watch the Sunday Ticket at 3 locations, Cleveland Avenue in Santa Rosa, Rohnert Park on Commerce, and Novato. Order up their legendary crispy curly pepperoni pizza. Try their new sticky Kogi wings or kickin' Korean barbecue wings. Online at mountainmikes.com.
There's no place we'd rather be.
In the KSRO kitchen, Steve Garner along with Chef John Ash and Chef To David Fu, who co-wrote this book with Soleil Ho, who was the restaurant critic for The Chronicle for about 4 years. The new book just out called The Memory of Taste, Vietnamese-American Recipes from Phu Quoc, Oakland, and the Spaces Between. The chapters are Me and Ba's Kitchen, Chapter 1, Chapter 2, We Are from Phu Quoc Island. Number 3 is We Are Ocean People. Number 4, We Lived Through War. And John, you were quite taken with chapter number 5.
Well, you mentioned it a while back in this interview about authentic cooking, that people, often chefs, will present themselves or their recipes as authentic, whatever that is. And the title of that thing, we are as inauthentic as hell, I thought was great.
Would you talk a little bit about that?
And authenticity, what does that mean?
Yes, I think I always like to tell a story when we talk about chapter 5 or being inauthentic or authentic, is that we lived in an apartment building and our neighbor was this amazing, beautiful Korean, 100% Korean blood woman that spoke fluent Vietnamese because her family lived in diaspora in Vietnam, enterprising ginseng. And as a kid, as a five-year-old, as a 10-year-old, she would cook for us all the time, give us food, teach my mother how to cook these very Korean dishes. I grew up so confused, thinking that that was Vietnamese food. So was it incorrect or inauthentic for my mother to cook those foods when there was this beautiful bond and connection, cultural bridge between those two, between those two neighbors, those two persons? Mm-hmm. In addition to that, if I could just pivot quickly into talking about how authenticity is being used in the food space, it's using it. My understanding of that definition is that it triggers the emotion, this feeling that something is genuine, right? Mm-hmm. And it's usually used around food, naturally so. However, I feel that, once again, that's another term that's inflated or used incorrectly, the same way sustainability is used, where people use it to validate or invalidate dishes to their liking or not. And there's just no way, when we talk about identity, let's talk about Jewish diaspora, right? Jewish diaspora is so complex. It's not just Sephardic and Ashkenazi, right? There's just so many different other nuances, because people of Jewish birthright and descent they've been distributed all over the world, right? Because of war and diaspora, through diaspora. But for you to tell them, this is not the way you're supposed to make a knish, or that's the other way, you're not supposed to make a pickle, like, that's totally incorrect. It's the idea, and it's the taste of something, and then they work with what they have. But for us, you know, we're living in this third space, my mother and I, my family and I, where we're not Vietnamese enough because, you know, we left Vietnam. And then we're not American enough because we're immigrants. Mm-hmm. So we exist in this perfect middle, right? And even if there's a notion or idea of what authentic Vietnamese is, I would go back and ask them, like, which region are you talking to? Mm. Or what region are you referring to? I feel that Vietnamese food is in the same place where Italian food was in the 80s, where, you know, when you talk about food identity, they weren't afforded too much identities in terms of, like, food and authenticity beyond lasagna, meatballs and spaghetti, and pizza, right? And that's where I'm at with authenticity, is that creating more nuances and diversity for identity that reflects into what people perceive as, you know, authentic or inauthentic.
Beautiful. The chapter 6 is "We Ate What the Garden Gave Us." Wonderful comments about your mother, who never let anything go to waste, and that why her soil was so rich and so productive.
So if there's one recipe I'm going to make right away, and you give a shout out to Costco, it's your mom's banana bread pudding.
Yeah, with our leftover Costco croissants. Yeah. That really took us by surprise.
You know, and I think most people can relate to that, because those Costco Kirkland croissants are great, and you get them for a great deal.
Yeah.
Right? So, and that's the thing for me, from my understanding about cooking, and that's why I'm celebrating my mother even more so in this cookbook, is that cooking isn't about the chef whites. It isn't about how expensive your ingredients are. It's actually about how resourceful you are. So. Mm.
Beautiful comment. Would you give us your favorite number today, David, between 1 and 10?
7.
Caller number 7 will win a copy of this brand new and very in-depth and emotional and brilliant cookbook called The Memory of Taste, Vietnamese American Recipes from Phu Quoc, Oakland, and Spaces Between. Caller number 7 at 636-1350 by 2 David Phu and Soleil Ho. Thank you so much, Chef, for joining John and me today. It's been an illuminating conversation.
Thank you, Steve and John. It's been my pleasure.
So keep in touch.
Please keep in touch.
Let us know what you're doing.
Will do. Thank you, guys.
Okay. Thank you so much. Back next week.
Yeah.
Hey, we'll be back in the KSRO kitchen.
Finally. Where have you been?
Where have we been? Following the news, it's Clark Wolf at the table. Thank you so much for listening. It means so much to John and I that you've supported the show for these many years. This is KSRO.
This is Sonoma County's News Talk.